Okay, is everybody back? Okay, good. Well, I hope you're there. Nobody said anything.
I'm here.
Okay. Those three people are disconnected. Okay, we will get started. We'll start today by, I'm really glad to be back after a month away, but I had a great trip. So is there any announcements? Karen, you want to start with yours? Oh, she might be one of the ones that got disconnected. Hopefully she'll call back in. Somehow, when I started the recording, a few people got disconnected. Usually you just have to enter a code and then you come right back, but some people didn't. Okay, well, I'll start. I have a couple of announcements. One is I sent in a follow-up email to the announcement of today's call that it's time to start planning for the AGU Climate Literacy Sessions. Gail and Jeannie, this is the one that I sent you the email about. This is the meeting of which I sent you the email about last year. But we coordinate a group of sessions. Last year we had 11 session proposals submitted. And so I need conveners and ideas. I sent out the link, and you can go to the Clean Network teleconference page, and there's a link there also to a Google Doc, which you can then list your name if you're interested in helping convene a session. There's a list of generic sessions that kind of reflect the kinds of things we submitted last year that you can assign on to help convene, or you can add other ideas. I do also have a link to the extra to the sessions that we actually ran last year. Some of our submitted sessions got combined after abstracts were submitted. So the link for that was in the email I sent earlier today. It's also, there's a link at the top of the Clean Network teleconference page to that Google Doc. And we can discuss this in further detail, but the deadline for those session proposals is April 20th. And while we want to have a nice spectrum of proposals, we really, as we've done every year, is try to make each session distinct enough so that people can really see where their efforts might best fit. So that's one announcement. The other announcement I wanted to make is more just a comment. At the beginning of my trip, which was mostly vacation, I had the opportunity to visit with climate change people at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia. And it was really an interesting experience there. I learned about one of their efforts that might resonate with this group. They had what was called a climate commission that was funded by the government originally. And the purpose of this wasn't the kinds of activities we're doing, but it was a government-led effort where the individuals who were members of the climate commission were available for workshops, were available to give talks about climate change, basically engaging with the public in various ways. But then they had an election and a new government came in that was very much in the area of climate deniers, and they abolished the Climate Commission. They just up and abolished it. They didn't just defund it. They just abolished it. But because they did it in such a public and vocal way, there was a huge public outcry. And they ended up having enough support that they were able to crowdsource funding and start a nonprofit organization. And the same people who were members of the Climate Commission were now part of this climate change. I forget now what the it was actually called, but they changed the last word from commission to something else. And they're doing the same thing they were doing before, but now it's totally a public non-government affiliated effort. So I just thought that was really interesting that they were able to raise that funding. So I just thought I'd share that with everybody.
Cool.
So are there other announcements?
This is Karen, and I'd like to announce that the NAAEE, North American Association for Environmental Education Conference, this year is going to be in Madison, Wisconsin, and it's scheduled for starting. The research symposium starts early in the week of October 17th, and the main conference starts the evening of Wednesday, October 19th, and runs through Saturday, October 22nd. and proposals are being accepted through March 31st. So as soon as we're done with the call, I'll send an email to everybody with a link to the details about proposal submission. But there are a significant number of people who have already submitted proposals about climate change education, so I'm expecting a vigorous thread through the conference of climate change sessions and activities, and encourage all of you to apply, especially if that's in your part of the world.
And Karen, I'll add on to that, is that what we've tried to do every year is to have a clean network roundtable. So there's different types of sessions you can have, and the roundtable allows you to have conversations with people who are at the meeting about the clean network and our efforts, and that's grown over the years. So I will submit such a proposal and invite anybody who thinks they might want to go to join me in being listed on that proposal, because we'd like multiple people from the Clean Network to participate in those conversations. But there's no preparation. This is really just talking to people about the Clean Network as they come up to the table. And Karen, you might want to sort of briefly say the other kinds of sessions that people might think about.
Okay. There's also half-day and full-day workshops, which are held on the Monday and Tuesday, and Clean Network groups have sponsored those. And then during the conference, the main body of the conference, there are 40-minute traditional presentations, 90-minute panels or symposia, also 90-minute hands-on sessions, and poster sessions, and then some short 10-minute sessions that are called Bright Spots, that are just brief introductions to programs. So there's a whole variety of programs, and they'll all be listed on the URL that I'm sending out.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Any other announcements?
This is Jim Bray from AMS. I would just like to remind people, if you know of K-12 teachers that might be interested, we are sort of finishing up our recruitment for our MORI project at the U.S. Naval Academy and Project Atmosphere at the National Weather Service Training Center. These are two-week in-residence workshops for K-12 teachers for professional development in atmospheric science and physical oceanography. There's absolutely no cost to the teachers. Everything is covered. We fly you out there. We provide a stipend, and it's a real blast. So if you know of any teachers, please pass that along. They can Google our website, and on our website there is an education and career section, and click that, and then click K-12 teachers, and you'll get all the information. Thanks.
Jim, could you send an email that just sort of, even if it just has the link to the site where the information is, that would be helpful. Send it to the listserv. Okay? Thanks. Any other
Sure. This is
comments?
Kristen. It's probably been a month or so, but since Jim brought up his workshop for teachers, we're still open for registration for our 11th annual Summer Institute for Climate Change Education, and the focus this summer is our the next generation science standards and climate change. It's 4 days. It's at McAllister College campus, beautiful campus in St. Paul, Minnesota, and all the details are on our website as well, climategen.org/summerinstitute. But feel free to email me if you have questions, and please share it with your networks.
Okay, great. Any other announcements? Okay, well, if not, we will move on to our presentation and conversation for today. The slides for today's presentation are on the Clean Network teleconference page, so hopefully everybody has downloaded them. Today we have Gail Francis and Jeannie Curtis, who are going to be talking to us about REAMP and collective impact. And I just want to sort of give a little bit of background. Many of you know that we've sort of been exploring how we can move to a more robust climate literacy collective impact. And in my looking into this, I found REAMP, which was one of the a successful collective impact effort in the Midwest that is involved around energy conservation. And so as an example of sort of aligned with the kinds of goals that the Clean Network has, that's been a successful collective impact effort. So I wanted to introduce our speakers. Gail Francis is the knowledge manager for REAMP, and which she'll describe as a network of 147 organizations working to transform the Midwest energy system to rely on clean, safe, and renewable fuels. And Jeannie Curtis is the founding executive director of the Garfield Foundation, which has helped promote and get this group moving forward. So with that, I'll turn it over to Gail and to Jeannie and to give you more information and lead a discussion around REAMP and collective impact.
Thank you very much. This is Jenny Curtis. I'm going to kick us off. And thanks for the introduction. Just to mention, there are more detailed bios on the Clean Network website. I also wanted to suggest there's three different handouts that you can link to on the Clean Network website. I'd suggest that you go to the PDF document. It would be really helpful if you could follow along. It's just the slides. They are numbered, but as we move through the presentation, we'll go ahead and mention what slide that we're on, and hopefully that'll make it easy for you to follow along. We will take questions at the end. If you don't mind, we'll move through the presentation and then be open to questions you might want to jot down as things emerge for you, and of course we can circle back around to them. So it's a real pleasure for us to share information with you about the REAMP Network. Gail and I have been involved with REAMP for a very long time. The Garfield Foundation is one of the founding members of REAMP, so I've been involved since 2003. And Gail has been working on the support staff side of REAMP starting just a couple years after that. So we'll look forward to the discussion that will ensue. So if you're looking at the PDF, if you go to slide two, you'll... And if I could see you, I'd ask for a show of hands of how many of you are familiar with REAMP. And I have to say I'm impressed to hear, you know, in your introductions and updates at the beginning that so much of your activity is going on in the Midwest. And, you know, I hope after this presentation maybe your individual organizations will be inspired to join the network, which is certainly open to additional members. Anyway, this picture here is Gail and me, Gail on the left, and myself, Jenny, on the right, just to give you some visual of who you're speaking to and who's presenting to you. Here's what we'll cover today. So why the Midwest and why a network approach there, and how is REAMP grounded in systems thinking? We'll provide an overview of how REAMP strives towards strategic alignment, and what's the model and its infrastructure. And we'll also touch upon REAMP's impact and how it's evolved, including some of its challenges. Let's get started. So go to the next slide, slide number three. So why did REAMP emerge in the Midwest? Well, due to its the Midwest's heavy reliance on coal and its strong manufacturing base, the states of the upper Midwest have contributed to vastly disproportionate amounts of carbon into the atmosphere, resulting in climate change impacts and compromising the health and well-being of our communities here. And yet, while the region's decades-long carbon pollution problem is immense, the political opportunities here were and are promising. Midwestern politics tend towards centrism, which enables compromise on what is often but shouldn't be polarizing issues such as energy and climate. Some 12 years ago now, our hunch was that if the Midwest could make progress, make the progress we knew it must, it could definitely be a leader and linchpin for national progress toward a clean energy future. So motivated by this unique opportunity for impact, a growing number of organizations have been working together as the REAMP Network, boldly affecting progress to significantly reduce the Midwest carbon footprint. If you'll go to the next slide, please. So why a network approach? Typical to the U.S. philanthropic operating procedures, the paradigm for philanthropy is that individual foundations determine their priorities or what change they hope to see in the world, and then put the word out so that organizations can apply and compete for funding awards. It's not exactly a scenario that inspires collaboration, cooperation, and collective steps toward solving complex problems in a sustained manner. So we found in 2003 that there was little dialogue between NGOs. A shared analysis was pretty weak between foundations. Program strategy discussion was mostly informal, and the discussion between funders and advocates seldom extended beyond offices. If you'll move to the next slide. So our hypothesis in 2003 was that alignment between and among clean energy advocates and philanthropy was both achievable and imperative in order to make progress on this highly complex problem. And those that joined REAMP in the early days agreed that business as usual just was not going to make the progress that was needed, that there were limited financial and human resources that could be deployed. It would be deployed more efficiently if done so collectively and in collaboration, and that together we're way smarter than that of individual institutions. So what we endeavored to create was the right conditions for strategic dialogue and collaborative action. And we wanted to do it in a manner that we could analyze the complexity of the problem we're all trying to solve with nonlinear systems thinking. This is slide six. With that in mind, in 2004, the originating group of 20 energy advocates and foundations came together to develop a systems map that unpacked the Midwest's energy system. The systems map on the screen is a result of that work. We're not intending for you to study the map now, but we did at least want to give you a visual of how detailed and complex that original systems map was. There are more than 150 elements in the map, which gives you an indication of how complex the system is we're trying to reform. If you go to the next slide. So the systems mapping process also helped the group agree on a core, very ambitious goal that in order to make the progress necessary to avert catastrophic climate change, there had to be an 80% reduction in carbon emissions by 2050 in economy-wide by 2030 from 2003 levels. This North Star goal is what every member agrees to before joining the network. Two very important elements emerged at this stage. First, we developed an understanding and together about the system we were trying to change. And second, we determined an ambitious goal together that has since driven the work and collaboration to make progress towards that goal. But let's turn back to the systems analysis for a moment. The systems map and the process of thinking about the Midwest energy systems at the time led to some important insights that ended up framing what has become the charge of the REAMP network. Participants identified four highly interrelated drivers that popped out of the systems map as key focal points to get to our 80% carbon reduction goals. We need to the map informed us that we needed to focus on increasing two things and decreasing two things. That's it. It sounds pretty simple, but it has been quite remarkable in how it's motivated the work and informed our work in the ensuing decade. The first was that the demand for energy efficiency and clean energy had to increase, while at the same time the demand for dirty energy, coal, had to decrease. A key insight was that we had to do this simultaneously and could see that if we did not do all four at once, we'd get unintended consequences that would drive us away instead of towards our 80% goal. For instance, if a campaign to shut down a coal plant wasn't accompanied by advocacy to increase energy efficiency measures or replace dirty coal with wind energy, then the campaign would end up being counterproductive. Now in 2016, the systems mapping insights might seem rather obvious, but keep in mind that this was 12 years ago when NGOs were remiss to even mention the words climate change, and there was very little focus on stopping new coal plants that were well into planning and permitting and the permitting process. what we've come to understand is that the point of a network approach is that people are talking together to make sure these insights are captured and acted upon. And bringing us to current day, the systems analysis has continued. For instance, our members have identified leverage points in the transportation sector and opportunities at the local level to make progress on carbon emission reductions in those sectors. If you go to the next slide, slide 8, the RAMP network has established the conditions for its members to think systemically and act collaboratively. Since its beginning, the network has been defined by its ambitious focus and by its innovative and adaptive approach to whole systems change. Through ongoing systems analysis, network members develop a honed understanding of the Midwest energy system and identify what changes would do the most to reduce carbon emissions. They then collaborate to align their strategies across 8 states in service of RAMP's clearly articulated goals. Next slide, number 9. Just to reiterate that goal, it's so important to our overall membership and what really drives the foundation and all the activities it does. RAMP aspires to reducing greenhouse gas emissions 80% from the electric generation sector by 2030 and economy-wide by 2050. The distinction in those two is that transportation and actions at local economy were added a few years post the original systems mapping, which really, the original map really focused on the electric generation versus the whole economy-wide use of renewable energies. So the next slide, number 10. The RAMP membership has grown significantly from the original 20 organizations that were represented in 2004. Now 170 organization members in 2016. At the beginning she said 146, but it's actually we have 170 organizational members. And I point that out because organizations can have multiple staff that would access RAMP. So even though it's 170 organizations, we have more than 450 individuals participating in various aspects of RAMP, its services, its online intranet, its capacity building, et cetera, which you'll hear more about from Gail in a moment. And in this membership, we also have 15 active foundation members. So this is not a network of foundations looking in. It's a network of foundations as active participants within. So moving to slide 11. So in summary, the RAMP network model can be summed up in this graphic. Based on systems analysis, creating the conditions for collaboration, committed to network-wide learning that helps us all strive to reach an extremely audacious goal. The RAMP network is accelerating the transition to get off fossil fuels in the Midwest and helping to establish the region as an influential swing vote in national and international decision-making. Our goal is audacious, and so is our resolve. Let me turn it over to Gail, Gail will elaborate on the actual structure of RAMP and some of the things we've accomplished during the last decade. Gail, over to you.
Great. Thanks, Jenny. So I'm on slide 12 now, where I'll be talking about how we try to realize the collaboration piece of our network. But before I get started, I do just want to say that it was really great to hear from you guys at the beginning with the different updates and so forth, and feel really inspired by what you guys are doing. And I also wanted to point out that as I had taken a note to say, oh, I need to make sure that our member organization, Climate Generation, knows about these people. And then I heard, I think it was Kristen speak up from Climate Generation. So that was wonderful. Jenny just pretty much covered sort of the foundational premise of RAMP, and so I'm going to talk about how we try to operationalize that. So if you go to slide 13, you'll see that we have some operational platforms for each of these things: regional alignment, state-based capacity building, effective campaigns, a commitment to learning, climate and energy funding, and regional energy headlines. And so I'm going to start by saying a little bit about how we've tried to align regionally. And if you go to slide 14, what you'll see is the working group. So coming out of the gate when we were formed, members aligned themselves into the various working groups, which Jenny mentioned earlier. So those were those, increasing clean energy, increasing energy efficiency, and fighting dirty coal. So those were the three groups. This here says electric sector, probably better named power sector. So those are the three groups that work on that original goal. And then, as Jenny mentioned, our analysis has continued to evolve. So if you look at the third one, there's a working group also for the direct regulation of carbon. So essentially, the idea is, okay, the power sector is going to get it out, you know, is going to get that cap or is going to get that reduction out of the power sector, but still we need some kind of cap on carbon to kind of get it everywhere else. So they have a pretty tall order in that group, but they've engaged at a number of interesting levels. When we began, there was some promising work being done through the Midwest Governors Association, and also they have made some interesting and effective plays at the state policy level, at the federal level, and of course now are working on the Clean Power Plan, trying to make sure that goes as effectively as possible. So that group was added later, and then the transportation working group came along not long after, and some advocates made a very compelling argument for getting aggressive reductions from the transportation sector. And at that time, we changed our goal to go economy-wide by 2050. So when we saw that transportation reductions were possible on the level that this group of advocates was saying, we made an even more aggressive goal. And then most recently, last year, we just founded the Local Solutions Working Group, and that's been a terrific group of advocates who have pointed out that, so primarily we're typically working on state policy, and they have pointed out a number of things, which was first of all that the opportunities in recent years have not been tremendous on all of the policies that we need, although certainly we continue to make strides. But at the state level, but at the local level, there's often a real hunger for a range of sustainability initiatives, which it turns out add up to meaningful carbon reductions. It's not, there's a way to engage in that, which is, you know, not just hodgepodge, but really getting meaningful reductions. And furthermore, that anything that's passed at the state, it has to typically be implemented at a local level anyway. And working at a local level also helps build the whole movement and the political will. So that they made a very good case for that. And so all of those working groups together, they are working toward our 80% goal. Now, if you look on slide 15, you'll see that there is another way, a more recent way, that members have also organized themselves, and that's into caucuses. So we have four caucuses: the youth, environmental justice, faith, and rural. And so these are people who certainly share that same goal, the 80% reduction. But when they think about how to achieve that goal, they think less about molecules and more about movements. And so the network is now becoming a place where if you are a person of faith in the Midwest and you're tied into a faith-based organization, you might find yourself joining REAMP so that you can join with other bright minds, people of faith who are thinking strategically about how to really build a movement among people of faith to grow the whole movement, which will lead to our goal. And then the same is true for the Rural Communities Caucus, the Youth Caucus, and the Environmental Justice Caucus. So that's been a great addition to our network. If you go to slide 16, so the idea here is there's a way of organizing oneself where you could see how, wow, this could really increase everybody just getting siloed. Oh, I'm working in this working group, these people are working in this caucus, and you could see that it could increase the silos. But we're constantly trying to work against that. So if you're within a working group, the idea is, yes, you're aligning yourself strategically with others in the working group, But then the working groups are also talking to each other and aligning their work strategically amongst themselves, and the same with caucuses, and then across caucus and working group as well. So this image here is, that's Stephanie Inlow. She is our fantastic rural caucus coordinator, and she is at a meeting of the Clean Energy Working Group, and these are two advocates from the Clean Energy Working Group. And at this conversation, what they're having is a conversation about rural electric co-ops. So it's a real sweet meeting of the minds here, because this is just a place where both that working group and that caucus can really make some big strides on greenhouse gas reductions and building the movement if they figure out a good strategy on this. So that's just an example of how we try to help provide opportunities for that collaboration to exist beyond just an individual caucus or working group. So that is the regional alignment for working, which is primarily done through working groups and caucuses. And if you go to slide 17, you'll see one of our newest platforms for collaboration are these burgeoning state tables. And the idea of the state table is that our members within a state ought to be able to not just collaborate together more effectively, but also, again, develop platforms of their own so that they can have shared capacity, shared analysis, shared campaigns. So again, to try to kind of decrease any kind of siloing that happens, with the idea being that the sum is greater than the parts. So I should say, though, that the state table work is grounded in the objectives established by the working groups, and they have a special mission also to focus on equity and also to include some built-in tracking and evaluation of their work. So that's at the state-based level. And then if you go to slide 18, this is an image of our annual meeting. So every full member of REAMP, they are expected to attend the annual meeting to send one member at least from their organization. And most of them do so quite happily. So we have this once a year, and it's a place for us to bring in some outside expertise to develop or to refresh our systems analysis, and even for our leaders to kind of take the heat if the members think that they are moving, you know, that our network is moving in the wrong direction, and for members to suggest alternate directions that we could be moving in. And this has been really useful for us to not get too set in our ways. Going on to slide 19, this is referring to our pooled set of funds. And so our pooled set of funds, which is called the Action Fund, we have different funders who pitch in together for a pool of about $2.1 million. And it's collective decision-making. And what we mean by that is it's not only the funders themselves who contribute, who collectively decide, but also there are elected representatives from the network, from the advocacy community, who help make these decisions. And this year, for the first time, we also appointed some additional members to help make sure we were getting greater diversity in the types of voices that were helping to make these decisions. Now, this fund is rather unique in that it's informed by intelligence on the ground. So it's not just a case, you know, Jenny showed that slide earlier of all the, you know, philanthropy, all the arrows pointing in different directions. And if your work happens to line up with an RFP, great, you jump on it. This process actually begins on the ground with members themselves coming together and saying what they think are the most promising opportunities and best uses of this resource. And then the proposals are reviewed by more members who have some expertise in these issue areas and sent forward then to this collective decision-making process. So I think that this fund has allowed us to do some work that others really haven't been funding. And I'll just give a couple brief examples of this. So beginning with our beginning, how Jenny was talking about at the time, there really was not a lot of funding going into an aggressive fight against these coal plants. And as many of you may know, there was a massive coal rush at the time that we were founded. And we were able to help fund some really incredible fights to keep those plants from being built. And really, nobody believed that we would have as much success as we would, which was partly why I think there was not so much funding going into it. But our members had a real appetite, not just our own members, of course, but all across the country. There was a real appetite for taking this on, and they did it. And we defeated all but one of these. I forget how many coal plants were proposed in the Midwest at the time, but it was, I mean, there were hundreds across the country, and it was heavily disproportionate in the Midwest. And the only one that was actually built, the advocates are not letting go of it. Even though it's brand new, they are still trying to take this thing down, and they just might succeed. That was an example early on, but some other examples that I think are useful is transmission is something that our members, because of their systems analysis, they've said, you know what, we've had a complicated relationship with transmission, but the wind is really, like, we need that pipeline to move the wind into our grid. And they've also said, though, that how it's happened in the past is not acceptable, and so what we need is a different model, one that doesn't just impose eminent domain on everybody, one that doesn't just devastate habitats. And so this is an area of funding that there's really very little other funding for this work, and it's being done in a very impressive way, I think. And it's an area of controversy within our network, but that our members have continued to prioritize it year over year. So there's a number of examples like that where it's not just that we're funding things other funders won't fund, because you know, that's not the name of the game. It's that we're funding things that are based on intelligence on the ground and a systems analysis. So, and this here happens to be a picture, actually, of another good example, which is this is a campaign to fight a highway expansion that would cut through communities and cause a lot of problems in Milwaukee. And so this is a campaign to, and again, there's not been a whole lot of funding, I think, around fighting highway boondoggles. And so this has been a fun thing in our network that we've been seeing some remarkable success from this great group of advocates. And speaking of campaigns, if you go to slide 20, then you'll see that another recent addition has been the Organizing Hub, which helps people run effective climate campaigns. So giving people, you know, the skills that they need through conferences, peer learning circles, deep and ongoing support, written guides, and so forth. And this has been a really big boost for our network in getting much smarter about how they campaign. And on slide 21, I also, we mentioned earlier our commitment to learning and the institution around that. And so this is actually my job, is to try to look across all of our 8 states, all of our 6 working groups, our 4 caucuses, and all these different strategies and campaigns, and try to help our members learn from each other, get smarter faster. I try to pull people together in small group conversations, or I'll write a report that gets disseminated, or run a webinar, whatever I can do to try to help people learn from each other, get smarter, faster, and then also identify gaps where we need help from outside the network. And this slide 22, then this began a few years ago where we helped kick off Midwest Energy News, which has become really a premier source of both energy news aggregation and original reporting throughout the Midwest. And this year they also launched a U.S. Energy News and a Southeast Energy News. So if anyone on this call isn't signed up for this service, I do highly recommend it. It's been a great thing for our network, for people to be able to every single day get this digest of news going on related to climate and energy. And on slide 23, you may be thinking, wow, that sounds like a lot of work. Does it actually add up to something? And we think it does. And I'll give you a abbreviated list of some of the things that we're really proud of and excited about on slide 24, which is I already mentioned that, you know, we stopped the massive coal rush that was happening in our region and could not be more proud of that. I don't think, you know, almost nothing else would have mattered if we hadn't been able to do that. And meanwhile, as Jenny mentioned, simultaneously using renewable and efficiency policies to drive market shifts. So while we were able to get some aggressive policies, still they were only maybe 15% by 2020, or 25% would have been a good one in the early days, 25% by 2025 or something of renewable energy. And what that did, though, is it gave the industries enough time to really get going. And now, of course, you see things like solar competing on a market basis with natural gas. Also, I mentioned earlier, stopping highway boondoggles, which, again, most people did not necessarily think was something you could really do. The road developers typically get their way. But also looking at the long game of pushing to make cities walkable, enjoyable, sustainable. So that's been some work of our transportation group. And I mentioned that we stopped coal from being built. Well, and now these same advocates have turned to shutting down coal. More than 150 coal plants just in the last few years have been slated for retirement. And one of the more exciting things that's come out of this was the coal working group has really realized that they need to do this in a way, in a conversation with the community who is impacted both positively and negatively. So many times the community is very excited to have a coal plant shut down due to the extreme health problems, but other times less so because a coal plant might be the biggest tax base or, of course, the jobs issue as well. So that's some of what we've achieved, and I'll just turn it back over to Jenny then to walk us through the last couple slides.
Great. Thanks, Gail. If you can go to the next slide. You know, as you can see from Gail, what Gail presented, there is a lot to REAMP's structure and the capacity building it offers to its members. And REAMP is always evolving. Here's just a short list of what we've been focused on during the past few months. So REAMP established just recently state tables. It took us a good year of figuring out how to do it before we were able to really put it in play, and it has just begun. And it's a way to embellish state action on clean energy that's informed by the regional opportunities that REAMP is so focused on. And REAMP is working with community-based groups, frontline communities, organizations that focus on environmental justice to build the movement against climate change. We had realized some years ago that because our membership is so extensive, we had this unique opportunity to really grow the movement, and we've been trying to actualize that. REAMP also continues to build member capacity by organizing and facilitating gatherings such as its Campaign Excellence Conference, Network Mindset, and Collaboration Skill Building Practicum, and a Systems Thinking Academy, and a firm in our absolute firm commitment to continued sharing of best practices. And REAMP extends its commitment and partnership with EJ groups by supporting an EJ caucus, Environmental Justice Caucus, and we have established a special Environmental Justice Regrants Fund that is co-managed with that caucus. And REAMP is working to increase its diversity, equity, inclusion practices within the network. We've been providing diversity, equity, inclusion training for staff and steering committee members, and we are going to be extending that out to our membership in 2016 and beyond. So we're always evolving, and those are just a few things that we're doing, and really there's so much more than I'm even mentioning. So if you go to the next slide, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention that REAMP, of course, isn't perfect. Challenges are ever present, but so are opportunities. And here's just to mention a few. While natural gas is a contributing factor to helping coal exit the energy-producing mix, the network hasn't really taken on in any organized manner the problems that natural gas poses, such as fracking, methane emissions, flaring, etc. Doesn't mean that our members aren't working on those issues, but they're not organized under REAMP's banner. And there are challenges completely out of our control, such as the region's changing demographics and the ever-shifting political landscape. The one thing that the opportunity that creates is under a network, we're able to be fairly responsive when a defensive measure is in order and when collective action is needed. So it's both a huge challenge, but yet being organized in our network makes us more ready to be responsive to it. Of course, there are resource constraints. It's an ever-present reality. And even while REAMP mobilizes a re-grants fund, it's never sufficient for the amount of work that needs to be happened over such an enormous region. And so it puts REAMP in a position where it and its membership really has to pick and choose what are the greatest opportunities to act on most immediately. And further, we're pretty focused on climate and energy funding, which has its limitations. As you know in your work, climate and energy extends so far beyond just that specific domain. I'm sure in your world that extends into the education sector, maybe the health sector, smart growth, livable community sector. REAMP, however, in its funding realm, has not gone much beyond climate and energy funders. And, of course, REAMP is a membership network, our members obviously have their own organizational commitments. So while we've negotiated differences quite well, it doesn't mean that they don't periodically affect the ability to collaborate well. We try to pay a lot of attention to that and help our members kind of move through so that both organizational priorities are met at the same time that we're able to create the conditions for collective action. And then finally, REAMP has grown so rapidly in the last 12 years. We went from 20 members at the onset to now 170 members. So it makes it a little bit challenging to adhere to our roots and systems thinking. It's something that requires constant attention so that we don't end up deviating too far from our ambitious goal. I hope that our awareness of that helps us also keep on track. So, and then if we can move to slide 27. So in wrapping up, we thought it would be useful to share a few lessons learned. It was really imperative to REAMP's success that it understand the system it was trying to reform. In REAMP's case, we used a systems mapping technique in order to do so, and REAMP has evolved and deployed other systems tools as we've added different elements of the economy's contribution to carbon pollution. So we are very firm and committed to our systems, whole systems analysis. And another element is we believe it's been highly effective to involve both funders and nonprofits from the get-go as partners. It's helped foundations to deploy its financial resources more effectively and informed by on-the-ground intelligence. And it's helped advocates in the region to collaborate more effectively. And we've designed REAMP for a network, not an organization. This is really important. The investments made in the collective infrastructure and have been dispersed throughout the region, allowing various member organizations to take responsibility for various bits of the operation and getting the grants directly to do so. We do and have evolved to having a centralized office, but we still also have this dispersed membership responsibility as well. So we've evolved into a bit of a hybrid, but REAMP is clearly a network and not some distinctive standalone organization. We also believe it's essential to cultivate leadership and create multiple opportunities, connect, communicate, and collaborate. As Gail reviewed many instances of that, such as the REAMP annual meeting, working groups, state tables, various capacity building offerings, meeting in person or virtually. REAMP is absolutely all about helping to cultivate leadership and create multiple opportunities to connect. And finally, REAMP is committed to being adaptive and emergent. in service to its long-term vision. It's absolutely not a static operation, but it evolves as the needs of the membership does, or strategies to shift to take advantage of opportunities that will get us closer to our North Star goal. So with that, we'll pause and conclude the presentation, but open the floor to questions, comments, or insights from your own experiences. So we welcome that and invite you, if you'd like to make a comment or two. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Does anybody have any questions? Well, I have a few.
Where do you stand?
Go ahead and ask your question. Okay, so first of all, you set this very lofty goal of 80% in 2050. How did those numbers emerge? Was it is part of your conversations your systems thinking that this kind of emerged? Because for me, it's hard to see how you would know how what is doable in terms of what the activities might be.
Well, this is Jenny. I'll start. I would call it lofty. It's actually verified by some scientific analysis. Early on when we were doing the systems mapping, we commissioned a couple different reports, which we've done throughout the life of REAMP. The original reports were produced by the Union of Concerned Scientists, who were doing an analysis of what would it take to get the carbon emissions, carbon pollution, down to the level that it needed to be sustained at. And so the goal was verified and re-verified. What has shifted over the years, and maybe Gal would want to say something about this, is what portion of the carbon reduction has to be picked up by, say, energy efficiency reductions or an increase in clean energy production or, shutting down some dirty fossil fuel production. So this is verified. It's not lofty, and but I can tell you in 2005, people were nervous to talk about it publicly because it was so shunned. It was at a period when, we couldn't even speak about climate change as a verifiable reality.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I don't know if you want to add to that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, and I had meant to mention earlier the periodic, outside analysis that we've used to help inform both our overarching goal and then our, more near-term goals as we've moved through this work. But it's definitely a heavy lift, especially since we've moved from beyond the power sector and into the economy-wide, because there are, so many aspects of the economy that are contributing emissions, which we don't have the structure to match those aspects, tons of industry that don't have anything to do with the power sector, emitting tons of greenhouse gases, or for that matter, even as Jenny mentioned, we don't have a collaboration structure to deal with natural gas, and we didn't have one to deal with the tar sands. We haven't had anything for that, so it is a huge lift, but because it's technologically possible to achieve it, and we can see that it's technologically possible, I think that's helped us remain committed to it.
Another question that I have is, you mentioned the working groups, and I was wondering how those are constituted, how large they are, and are they more of a coordinating effort or an action activity within the group itself?
That's a really great question. I'll take a first stab at it, and Jenny, feel free to jump in. So each working group elects its own working group leader, and that working group leader also typically hires an associate to help them with the work. I'm sorry?
With what money?
Oh, so it's funded through REAMP, through the the core budget of REAMP. And so the working groups have quite a bit of latitude about how they want to structure themselves, and some, for example, our direct regulation of carbon group, it does do much more coordination of different of different campaigns, for example. Other working groups view themselves more as a place where people can go to get expertise. Other working groups view themselves as a place where they can discuss amongst themselves how to co-create strategies. So, you know, for better or for worse, and I think mostly for better, the working groups tend to figure out for themselves their own culture and how they want to align themselves. But that is sort of the main idea, is that there should be some kind of alignment and co-creation of strategies in those groups.
And how large do these are these?
Oh, right. That also varies quite a bit. So I think we have, you know, one working group that probably has an average monthly call of maybe 15 people, and then probably our largest one would have an average monthly call of maybe 40 people.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah,
Do they physically get together also?
Yeah, they do. At least once a year, each working group holds an in-person meeting, and often they hold them in conjunction with another working group so that they're maximizing that cross-fertilization.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just add, because it might be slightly confusing, there are about 12 foundations that contribute to REAMP's overall budget. It's about in the ballpark of $3 million annually, two-thirds of which is re-granted to other organizations to actually do coordinated campaign type of work. And this just recent round of grants was to... In addition to specific campaigns, was to set up these state tables and help our members and beyond other partners collaborate at the state level and take advantage of the opportunities there. So REAMP has a very real budget, and I think that's one of the outcomes of having philanthropy and advocates partner in as equitable manner as possible, as we can see, me being from the philanthropic side of the participation base, that it's putting this infrastructure in place, making sure that it's adequately funded at least, has really produced tremendous results. So much of the infrastructure that Gail talked about is very intentional funding that leads up to what we consider, you know, the RAM network.
Mm-hmm.
I can't see the names on the participating organizations. Can you tell us a little bit about the composition in terms of power-producing corporations versus nonprofits versus, you know, what type of participating organizations there are?
Sure. So, yeah, actually, I guess we should have mentioned that all of our members are nonprofits. So they're either, they're either traditional environmental groups or, as I mentioned, faith groups or youth-based organizations that maybe would have, energy as a side issue, but they do agree to the goal, or their foundations. But it's all nonprofit. We only have membership open to nonprofits.
Yeah, we should have mentioned, perhaps that could have been put in the challenges category, that while REAMP has an increasingly diverse nonprofit membership, it has not necessarily tried to be more multi-stakeholder than that by including businesses, corporations, utility executives, etc. But it doesn't mean our membership doesn't. And so the value of our being perhaps a little bit more homogeneous is still that those relationships that our individual members have are useful in the conversation and the strategy that gets deployed through the network.
So what kind of organizations are these nonprofits if they're not energy? I mean, so they're not energy companies or things like that? So
you know, you can totally. Go ahead, DL.
Okay. Many of them would be organizations you've heard of, you know, Sierra Club, League of Conservation Voters, so on and so forth. And you can actually see our full membership list if you want to go to reamp.org. But also probably a lot you haven't heard of, many local organizations. So it's or as I said, faith-based or environmental justice organizations, some Blue-Green Alliance. You know, so some labor groups as well. It's become a pretty diverse mix.
Yeah. So all of these groups are really just putting pressure on governments to change policies and on energy companies to change their practices. Is that what the activity is?
No, you go ahead, Jenny. I talked last time.
Oh. Okay. It goes far beyond that. So a lot of these organizations are involved in the advocacy that goes into getting the policy changed that then creates the conditions for utility companies and corporations to make the change that they have to do, motivated by the regulations that are put in place and that they have to follow. There's also some of our membership that are in deep conversation with utility companies about doing things like, for instance, changing utility business models or changing the practices and when new buildings are being established so that they're more highly energy efficient, or creating zoning at the local level. Our local solutions working group spends quite a bit of time on looking at what are the local policies and regulations that have to be put into place to create the conditions for more walkable, livable, sustainable communities, for instance. There's a whole suite of our membership that really helps local affected frontline communities have voice in whether or not different clean energy or dirty energy alternatives get built close to their communities. So it's really this very broad suite of various actors that might be behind the scenes to most people, but very much have a role in creating the conditions for a more clean energy future.
Very interesting.
Have you written up a summary? What I'm looking at, so much of the power of what you're doing is collaboration and synergy. And have you written up a summary of those synergistic wins, whereby in those, you showed slides of different people working together in different groups, and I assume you kind of promote that at all levels. Have you written up any summary of your findings?
Well, there's a couple things I can say about that, and if you go to the REAMP website, very simple, www.reamp.org, right on the on the front page, there is a link to a YouTube video clip that tries to very succinctly summarize some of the progress that the REAMP network has helped with. There's two other reports on there. One is by the Monitor Institute. It's a couple years old now, but it definitely lays out the plan of why this network approach. And then there's another one that also a little bit dated. The video clip's the most current, but the, there's another one called Leading from the Edge on the REAMP website that also highlights some of the progress that has been able to be emboldened because of the network approach. And the only other, one other thing I want to say about that is there's been a very robust debate within our REAMP leadership about how outward-facing REAMP should be. Are we in the business of supporting our members to be outward-facing, or is it more effective for REAMP to be outward-facing? And so really we have made very conscious decision over since REAMP was established to really be behind the scenes pushing our membership forward. You're not going to see a lot, like you're not going to see a news article saying the REAMP network is advocating for X. You know, what we're hoping you're going to see instead is, our members that are definitely getting the credit for the work and are more effective in moving the agenda along because of that.
Got it. Thank you very much.
Okay, so we are past the top of the hour, but I didn't want to cut off conversation. Are there any other questions? Well, I'm sure I would like to continue the conversation at another time, but this has been really, really interesting and very valuable, at least to me. I'm sure to everybody else on the call. So I want to thank both of you, Jenny and Gail, for your presentation today, and thanks very much for engaging with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is wonderful.
Thank you so much.
What a great job you're doing.
Could be a model for other communities.
Yes.
And Tamara, connect this. Please help us connect this to our prior conversations about collaborative impact.
Yes, that's what I'm working on. So I'm sure I'll have further conversations with Gail and Jenny.
Okay, goodbye, everybody. So good to spend the last hour with you.
Bye,
we need you out here in Southern California.
Thank you very much.
Thank